He yelled for your son to ring 999, but before that could happen, the intruder had got into your boy's bedroom and was on him. She lifted her head, and for a moment Trevor thought she was finished. But instead she seemed to study them intently before she added, Bruce says this bloke was shouting about someone getting his daughter drunk, stripping her, then raping. Trevor heard nothing after raping. He looked at Clover. For a moment his ears were filled with roaring, as a number of what had appeared to be disparate pieces slid into place. This was what Clover had been intent upon hiding. This was what she must have learned at some point on the 26th of February. This would demand any number of phone calls between Gaz and her. This is what she had been dealing with ever since. Trevor came round as Clover was saying, "Talked about a daughter? So the intruder was an older man? Was Bruce able to give you a description?" "Fairly good one. I reckon he'll recognise the bloke when we bring him in." "You know who it was?" Clover spoke sharply. Havers waited a moment before replying, as if assessing Clover's tone. "Since the bloke was shouting about his daughter being raped, I reckon once we know who the daughter is, we'll know the attacker." Trevor got himself together enough to say, "Are you saying my son? Our son? Have you taken a statement from Finnegan yet? Emergency staff are still working on him, and the girl who made the call? Like I said, my gov's with her. She's the girl who lives there as well. Did she—" "Thank you, Sergeant." Clover cut him off, and Trevor felt the anger like a band round his forehead that tightened and tightened, not only at this public slighting of him, but also at his allowing this sort of thing to happen again and again, resulting in where they were at the moment. Clover added, "May I ask how you happened to be on the scene?" Again that unnerving pause, in which the sergeant tapped her pencil against her notebook. Trevor became aware of the life of A&E going on round them, another trolley being rushed through the corridor, a white-coated Indian woman calling out from a doorway for a series of drugs and procedures. Havers finally said, "My gov and I have gone to interview the girl, Dina, called Ding. Do you know her?"
"About the rape?" Trevor asked.
"We've met her," Clover said, "but we don't know her well. She wasn't also attacked, was she?" "She wasn't at home when it started. It was all going on when she got there." "Thank you, Sergeant."
And then with a turn to Trevor, she said, "Darling, let's have a word with the staff."
She took his arm and they walked back towards the reception counter, with Trevor saying tersely, "Darling, let's have a word. That's the bloody conversational conclusion that seems reasonable to you." She drew him to one side, quite near to the wall. She spoke in a voice that sounded low with fury. "I have no intention of getting into anything here, and neither should you have. We need to know what happened, and we just got bloody told what happened. Someone got into Finnegan's house, and that someone believes his daughter was raped. Or did you miss that part?"
When she looked away from him, he wanted to force her somehow to meet his gaze. Instead, he said,
"This is what you've been protecting him from, isn't it? For months now, you and Gaz. You think Finnegan set out to get a girl drunk, and when he had her completely defenceless, he raped her. You actually believe our son—" She whirled to him. "Stop it," she hissed. "Stop it, just stop. Do you have any idea how often it happens? There you are in your precious fitness center with absolutely no clue what goes on in the rest of the world. Well, let me tell you, this is going on everywhere. Brainless girls drinking too much and brainless boys taking advantage of that. Sometimes it's only drink involved, and sometimes it's more. Sometimes it's something slipped into the drink to speed things along. Do you not understand that?"
"What I understand is that you appear to see Finn as someone who could do this in the first place."
"I see it, because it happens!"
She spoke fiercely, and her expression told Trevor she'd be happy enough to beat her point into his head with her fists.
"Perfectly nice boys talk to other perfectly nice boys, and they cook up a plan, or they see this sort of thing reported on the internet, and they think, 'Shall we give it a try?' So they take a decision, and they don't think there might actually be consequences, because boys that age never think there might be consequences to anything they do. And when they do something like this, something that's completely beyond the pale like this, and it's reported, then their lives are shattered. I'm talking about his life, Trevor, Finnegan's life. Do you understand now? We, you and I, his parents, can't lift a finger to protect him if he's charged with this. We can find him a solicitor, and we can make absolutely bloody sure, if he will even let us, which is seriously open to doubt, as it has always been, that he will not say a word to anyone else when he's alone with them. But that's it. And if there's evidence involved in what he's been accused of, because believe me, there is no girl alive who wants to be sodomized, so there will be evidence, then a solicitor means nothing, because there is also no solicitor alive who can fight DNA no matter how good he is."
Trevor had heard it all without hearing, because everything halted when she said the word
sodomized. She apparently read his reaction on his face, because she said, "Yes, that's what happened. Are you happy to know it?" "How the hell?" Trevor licked his lips. They were dry as stones. "How the hell do you know all this? Christ, Clover, did Finn tell you?" She looked beyond him to the wall before she replied. Then it was to say, "Ian Druitt turned evidence over to Gaz."
"Druitt?"
"Druitt. Now do you see what we're dealing with?" Ludlow, Shropshire. Once the patrol officer had left to fetch the photographs for Inspector Linley from Mrs. Lomax, the detective took Ding upstairs to gather what she would need for a few days at home. She knew that her mother would be hurtling down from Much Wenlock in order to cart her back to Cardew Hall, and she understood that she was going to have to cooperate as fully as she could with a detective in order to escape having to live there permanently. So she would look at the photos fetched from Mrs. Gran, and if Mrs. Dad was in any of them, Ding was going to have to point to him if indeed he was the person who broken Brutus's arm and mangled Finn's head. As for Cardew Hall itself, it wasn't as if a sudden understanding of her nightmare reaction to the place had altered anything. She still had come upon her father's naked body, strung up to a bedpost. She still had buried everything inside her head, and for years acted as she'd acted because of that. Having to stay there with her mum and stepdad while things were being sorted here in Ludlow was going to be bad enough. Having to live there till she got to university was something she knew she couldn't cope with. Linley instructed her to be careful and not touch anything as they went up the stairs. Everything, including every surface, he said, held potential evidence. Inside, he asked her to look round first, to see if anything had been disturbed. When she told him that it looked the way it always looked, he handed her a pair of latex gloves and said that she could take 3 changes of clothes. She had a duffel, and as quickly as she could, she stuffed into it what she thought she might need. He waited quietly, and she could feel him watching her every move. When she glanced his way, his expression told her that although he could be compassionate, he wasn't about to sign on as her friend. They went outside when she had her belongings gathered. They paused in what went for the front garden, which was just the concrete square upon which she and Brutus stood their bicycles. She was glad enough to be out of the house, but less glad when she saw that a small crowd had gathered across the street. A gent that Ding recognized as their next-door neighbor was among them, she saw, and he crossed over quickly as she and Linley emerged. There was no crime scene tape yet. No one apparently had had the time, or perhaps they didn't carry it about in their cars, so he started to come onto the property. His name rose to her brain unbidden. "Mr. Keegan," he was called. Linley stopped him with, "This is a crime scene, sir. You'll need to stand back across the street." Mr. Keegan said that he had information. He was fertilizing his roses just over there. He indicated the next tiny plot of garden, and he saw the bloke in question making a run for it, heading in the direction of Old Street. He was carrying a stick or something, he was. Mr. Keegan couldn't quite see, as the bloke was at a distance by then, and he himself wasn't wearing his distance specs, but whatever it was the man was carrying, he well could have thrown it over the wall and into the river. It might be in the water as they spoke, and it also might be on the bank. He added, "Watch the telly, I do, so you lot might want to do a search. Not the girl, of course. You and the other coppers." That was extremely helpful, Linley said politely. An officer would inspect the entire area as soon as Socko arrived. Mr. Keegan looked dead pleased at that. A citizen doing his duty, not to mention making a contribution to whatever the coppers intended to do to resolve what had occurred in the house. Ding said, when Mr. Keegan crossed back to the other pavement, presumably to watch whatever proceedings he reckoned were going to happen next, "Do you know if Finn... will he be okay?" Linley appeared to be waiting for Mr. Keegan to be among the other onlookers once again before he turned to Ding and said, "My sergeant will ring me once there's news. Tell me about the end of term in December. Do your best not to leave anything out."
"But you said that Missa—"
"We need to hear every version, Ding. Sergeant Havers will be talking to Bruce, to Brutus, at the hospital. She'll talk to Finn as well, if he's able."
"So you'll know if someone's lying?"
"So we have every possible bit of information." She gave him the details as she recalled them. The large gathering of college students at the Hart and Hind on a snowy night. Freezing cold it was, but Jack Corhanan,
he's the publican,
always put out heaters for the smokers and for the overflow as well, since he wouldn't want to lose the business. They'd arrived early enough to get a table inside.
At least, Brutus got there early enough,
and Finn arrived round 45 minutes later.
How did you get there? Mrs. Gran had arranged for a car because of the weather and all that, and so they wouldn't have to worry about getting back home at the end of the evening if they were, well, sort of lit up. Mrs. Lomax wanted Missa to have a nice time because she mostly studied, and, being honest, she's so dead prim and proper, and it was time for her to have a bit of fun. That's what Ding thought, and it seemed to her that Mrs. Lomax thought the same.
I don't think she'd ever been inside a pub, Ding said. Missa, I mean. Her dad's something like a drunk, I think. She doesn't say much about it, but I got that idea, and one time she said her uncle's the same. She was way seriously concerned about how drinking might get to her as well, as she never did. Drink, I mean. Never.
What was the difference about that night?
This is me and Brutus. We wanted her to loosen up a bit. We did it for a lark. We didn't mean anything by it. And it wasn't like her gran didn't want her to live it up or whatever. She even said, like, live a little or something. See, all Miss Avery did was study. And of course her marks were super amazing because of it. And there was a boyfriend as well, I suppose.
A college boyfriend?
Oh, no, not from the college. This is her at-home boyfriend. They were meant to be taking a break from each other while she was here at college, but it didn't work that way since he rang her, like, every day, and he texted her, I don't know, perhaps 6 times a day.
How did she feel about that? Did she tell you?
Not really. I know her gran wasn't, like, totally on board with the idea of the bloke. Missa told me that. Something like, at least I'm not at gran's, one time when he rang her. It seems like everyone in her family wants her to, I don't know, meet someone else. And she wasn't going to do that, was she, if she didn't break away from him for a while, you know?
Ding was still holding her small duffel. She set it at her feet. Then she picked it up again because she found she needed to do something with her hands, and this was as good as anything.
She said, anyway, that was part of what we wanted to do, me and Brutus. We wanted her to see there was fun to be had if she just let herself have it. So we told each other we'd have a go with cider and see if she liked it. And she did, and she was on her way to having a fun evening, but then Brutus kept on.
Kept on?
Sorry, he kept on giving her cider. She would drink one and there would be another in front of her. When Finn got there, he joined in, except he was drinking Guinness, not cider, and we all got pissed out of our minds, which is how we were when Gaz Ruddock showed up.
She twisted the canvas handles of a duffel as she recalled the evening and how it unfolded and knew how much she was responsible for and how little she wanted to be responsible for.
I think he was there to check on Finn or something like that, because when Finn saw him, he got all super annoyed. But then Gaz saw me and how I was, and he grabbed onto me and said, right then, I'm taking you home to your mum, because it's time she learned what you're up to in Ludlow.
Did he intend to take you home? Or was this more of the usual, as you explained yesterday?
I reckoned it was worse this time, because he talked about my mum. For things to work for him, though, he had to take everyone home, since it would look dead odd if we were all pissed, and he chose only me to cart off, so he grabbed a lot of us. Only there wasn't room enough in the back seat, so he put me in the front, which is how I made a run for it once we got to Teamside. The rest of them he shoved into the house.
Miss her as well?
I expect she didn't want to go home to her gran in that condition, only I didn't know that, see, because I was running fast as I could away from him. I just didn't want to have to, you know, with him.
Where did you go?
It was slippery and everything because of the snow, and I knew he could catch me up fast if he came after me, so I ducked into where the rug shop is, just along the street. She pointed in the general direction. There's wheelie bins there, and I hid behind them. But it was freezing, and it started snowing again, so I was there maybe a quarter of an hour, 20 minutes, something like that. When I couldn't stand it any longer, I went to the pavement and peeked round, and there was no patrol car in front of the house, so I went home.
And Missa was there, on the sofa in the sitting room?
I didn't know, Ding said. I didn't even look in there. I reckoned that she'd rung the bloke who took us up to Quality Square. She had his card and all that, so I thought she'd gone home. All I did when I got to the house was run upstairs.
You found her the next morning, I presume, Lindley said.
Not even, Ding told him. See, she wasn't there. She must have rung the bloke to fetch her at some point, like I said, because she wasn't there in the morning either.
Lindley looked away from her. He had his eyes fixed on her so steadily that Ding felt as if he'd been reading her brain so that no matter what, he'd know the truth. As she was waiting for what would come next, a white van stopped in front of the house, and out of it hopped 3 blokes, who went to the back of it, opened its cargo hold, and began pulling white boiler suits over their clothes. She'd seen enough detective programs on telly to know this was the crime scene team. The inspector told her to wait, went over to have a word, and then returned. Shortly thereafter, the first 2 of them went into the house, carrying impressive toolkits,
while the third unspooled the yellow crime scene tape that they were always unspooling on telly. Once all of the crime scene team were inside the house, Lindley spoke to her again. He said, "When did Missa tell you what had happened to her?"
"A few days later. I could see that something was wrong, and when she told me, see, I thought it was Brutus. He'd kept on with a cider, see? He knew it would get her completely wrecked. And he has... Brutus has this thing for girls. He can't leave them alone."
"Beyond that, is there anything else that told you it was Brutus?"
She had to look away.
It was his eyes, she reckoned. He was a handsome man anyway, but his eyes made one want to... She didn't know, only that they were deeply brown and they wanted her to tell the truth. When she looked back at him, the eyes were still waiting. She said,
"When I got up to my room, he was there."
"Brutus?"
"We slept together most nights, and there he was like always. He woke up when I came in, and he wanted sex, like usual, but I didn't. He was annoyed for a bit, but we fell asleep. Then I woke up later, and, you see, he wasn't there. After Missa told me what she told me, I thought it was Brutus who did it to her, only it turned out he was in the bathroom, and he'd passed out and slept there in front of the loo. He said sometime during the night he woke up because Finn was peeing over him and not being especially careful where it all went, and he was laughing the way Finn laughs, like sort of a gotcha laugh. Only, you see, I never knew any of that. I only knew that Brutus wasn't there when I woke up."
"You didn't look for him?"
"I didn't think to. Why would I? Only when Missa told me what had happened, I worked it out. Or at least I thought I worked it out, but I couldn't ever be sure, could I? And Missa didn't know."
"Missa explained to us that she told Mr. Druitt. He could see something was very wrong, and he got the story from her. She seems to have wanted no one to know, as she considers it her fault. So how did you get the story from her?"
"Oh, I could tell. Like Mr. Druitt, I expect. Plus, she felt dead bad about my top, because she knew it was expensive, and I don't have a lot of money for clothes."
"Your top?" He looked perplexed. She explained how she had lent Missa clothing for the evening, how she'd even brought her a fancy bra as a Christmas gift. Missa had worn her own knickers and tights and the like, but the skirt and top were dings.
Missa didn't even own anything that said party, if you know what I mean, so I gave her something to wear. She knows I've been buying my own clothes since I was something like 11 years old. I like to keep them nice. When she gave them back, she apologized because the top got ripped, and then she started crying."
"So she told you then?"
"She was so out of... I don't know. She was way beyond how she should have been about a ripped top, which I reckoned I might be able to have repaired anyway. She told me, because that's what I said, that I could maybe get it repaired, and it was okay. But she wouldn't stop crying, and I kept asking, and the story came out. She asked me, please, please, not to tell anyone, because she was so, I guess, humiliated, which is how I pretty much would have felt as well. I promised not to tell, and I put the clothes in my cupboard, but I couldn't stop wondering if Brutus, you know... Then she talked to the deacon, and he wanted her to hand everything over for testing, what she was wearing, and I'm sorry, but then I lied. Because, see, I couldn't face it might have been Brutus. I just couldn't. So I lied to her, and I know it was wrong to do that, but I did. I told her I chucked the top into the rubbish, and I'd worn the skirt so much after what had happened that it finally needed to be dry cleaned."
"But that's not what actually happened."
"I kept it. I kept both of them, the skirt and the top. And then one day I lost my temper bad, and I threw them at Brutus."
"What did he do with them, do you know? Did he take them from your room, for example?"
"Oh, I threw them at him in his room, not mine."
She hated to tell the rest of it because of how dumb it all had been for so very long between Brutus and her, but she continued.
"See, Brutus brought a girl home to spend the night, and he'd never ever done that before. I'd been protecting him for ages because, like I said, I was scared it was him who'd hurt Missa. Then all of a sudden there he is, doing it with this random girl, and he'd let her spend the night, like right in my face. I was over the edge at that. So I got the clothes and I banged on his door and I threw them at him and screamed about how I'd been protecting him when all along I could have just turned the top into the cops, the skirt as well. He might have tossed them out after that, but I don't know."
Lindley nodded. He looked back at the house. He looked at some ancient pocket watch. Then he said to her, "Take me to his room, Ding." Which was what she did. Royal Shrewsbury Hospital, near Shelton, Shropshire. After Finn was moved from casualty to a hospital room, Trevor told his wife he would spend the night at their son's bedside. It was, at that point, after 10 p.m. He said to Clover that one of them needed to rest, and to be clear-headed, should any crucial decisions about Finn's treatment need to be made in the morning. He would ring her at once, should anything change in his condition. He would also ring her if Finn regained consciousness. That latter was unlikely, they'd been told, so far as the night went. As to Finn's recovery, there might be some memory loss, but that would be assessed once he was fully conscious, and it was likely to be only temporary. Clover didn't want to leave at first, but Trevor managed to convince her of the good sense of doing so. She wanted a police officer posted at the door to Finn's room in the event his attacker showed up, and while Trevor didn't think that was necessary, he accepted it. Since the female detective from the Met had been the person to explain the incident to them, there was a chance she was still hanging about, and Trevor definitely didn't want her gaining access to Finn. Clover was in a state of anxiety when she finally departed. Trevor assured himself this was understandable. He couldn't consider anything else about Clover's concerns just then, because he wanted nothing to play on his features other than his disquiet about her level of exhaustion and the need for her to have her wits about her should a crucial decision need to be made. The reality, however, was that he wanted to be completely alone with his son should Finn regain consciousness. He was attempting to come to terms with what Clover apparently believed, that Finn was capable of sodomizing a girl. Before they'd been allowed to see Finn, Trevor had insisted that Clover give him every detail of the supposed crime, so he knew that the housemates had been drinking heavily in a pub on the night in question, which had been in December, after exams, that they'd been carted home by Gaz Ruddock, that one of them, Ding Donaldson, had done a runner, and that later that night someone had attacked another girl who passed out on the sitting-room sofa. At the end of her recitation, Clover had said, "Do you understand my concerns now?" He had said that he did. When he went on to tell her that this wasn't something Finn would have done, however, she raised her hands in defeat and spoke about the matter no further. Trevor remained silent and watchful in the room with Finn. The hours crept by with no change. A member of staff came into the room now and then to check the boy's vital signs, and when a police officer arrived to take a position outside the door, she popped her head into the room to let Trevor know all was well, whatever that was supposed to mean. He was thus mostly left with his thoughts, and he directed them towards trying to dredge up anything at all that indicated to him there was a part of Finn that he did not know. Finn regained consciousness just after 4 in the morning. Trevor was dozing in a chair next to the bed in the darkened room, but he was instantly awake when he heard the boy's voice murmur, "Mum?" Trevor rose, switched on a dim light, and reached for the plastic container of water that had been placed on the side table. "I'm here, Finn," he said. "Mum's getting some rest at home. Thirsty?"
"Yeah."
Finn went for the straw and drank the container dry.
"Thanks," he said.
And after a moment, in an exhausted and somewhat blurred voice that reminded Trevor so much of his son as a child awakened from sleep,
"Dad, who was that bloke?"
"The man who attacked you? We don't yet know."
"I heard a ruckus is what it was."
Finn's lips were so dry that they looked painful. Trevor made a mental note to purchase some balm for him. There had to be a shop on the premises.
"First I thought it was some random girl's father, like beating on Brutus because..."
He paused.
"Any more water?"
"I'll fetch it. Finish what you were going to say."
"Just that I reckoned it was like Brutus fucked the wrong girl for once, and here was her dad to do business on him, on Brutus."
"Would that be like Brutus?"
"Fucking, like... the wrong girl."
"Oh, sorry.
About fucking, Dad. I mean, he does it to any girl willing."
"What if the girl isn't willing?" Finn frowned. One of his eyes was closed and his head was wrapped in white bandaging. Aside from the injuries to his skull, he had a fractured clavicle, about which nothing could be done since it would heal on its own, a fractured shoulder and a broken wrist. He said with a wince as he moved his head,
"Far as I know, there's not, like, a girl been unwilling. Don't know what it is about him, do I? He's got, like, a magic dick or something. Could I have water?"
Trevor hastened to get it from the basin. He let the water grow cool from the tap, and he wondered about it all. Truth, lies, actions, reactions. And then he wondered about his wondering. He returned to the bed and helped his son drink. He said to him,
"Finn, something happened back in December, at your house."
Finn rested his head back on the pillow and shut his eyes.
"What?"
He sounded drowsy.
"A girl was very badly assaulted. She was on the sofa in your sitting room, and she was drunk." Ding, you mean?
Another girl. She'd gone out with Ding, and apparently she didn't want to go home drunk. Does this ring a bell?
Finn seemed to be searching for the correct memory. He said,
"Suppose it doesn't make sense it was Ding. For as I know, she always made it up the stairs. If she was too pissed and all that, Brutus would help her."
He was quiet for a moment before he added,
"They were like, you know, sleeping together. When Brutus wasn't doing some girl on the side, he can't resist women like they can't resist him."
"Do you remember this incident? When a girl slept on the sofa?"
Finn's eyes remained closed, and Trevor wanted him to open them. While the room remained dim from the single light he'd switched on, it still seemed that if he could see Finn's eyes, he'd know the truth, even though he told himself he did know the truth already. Finn would never, because he couldn't, because he wasn't the person his mother was declaring him to be.
Finn murmured,
"Incident?"
"In December, Finn. It was all of you, getting drunk, being carted home. Ding running off, another girl being with you. She would have gone into the house with you. Ding wasn't there, but this girl was."
"Suppose..."
Finn's voice was low. He was drifting off. Trevor touched his undamaged shoulder and said,
"Finn, in December this was. Do you remember?"
The boy nodded.
"December," he said.
But that was all.
May 24th. Ironbridge, Shropshire. When Yasmina awakened, it was 5 a.m., 2 hours before her alarm would ring. She found herself in the same circumstances in which she'd gone to bed on the previous night, alone in the house. While she'd learned from Rabia round 8:30 that Missa would remain in Ludlow for the night, and she'd not actually expected Sati to return home if Missa didn't come to fetch her, Yasmina had thought Timothy would arrive back at some point, even if his return happened in the wee hours of the morning. But he had not done so. Despite the hour, she rang Rabia. It seemed possible that Timothy might have ended up there. But he had not turned up, and Rabia's tone, when she learned from Yasmina that Timothy was missing, spoke of all the scenarios she was entertaining. Drink driving, fatal accident, overdose of opiates. God knew what else.
"Missa. How is Missa?"
Yasmina asked her.
"Were the police difficult? Did they treat her badly?"
"They were quite gentle with her. It wasn't at all as traumatic as it was when she told you and Tim."
"Will you tell her I've rung? That I am so terribly sorry for... I don't know what, Mum. What I put her through."
"This is no one's fault, but whoever it was who hurt her, Yasmina. But we all must prepare."
In Rabia's hesitation, then, Yasmina could tell that something else had occurred during the previous day. She could also hear her mother-in-law's reluctance to share the information with her. So she pressed her with,
"Mum, you must tell me whatever else has happened. I can tell something more is going on. I am worried about Timothy. If it's to do with him, please tell me."
A patrol officer had come by, asking for a photo of the family, Rabia admitted. Specifically, a picture that had a clear shot of Tim was wanted. When Rabia had asked why it was needed, the patrol officer said he didn't know, just that it was wanted.
"I had to give him one," Rabia told her. "I did ask him where he was taking it. At that point he became quite cagey. Yasmina, my dear."
She was silent then, and in that silence it seemed that Rabia knew very well why a photo of Timothy was needed.
"He's done something," Yasmina said.
After that phone call she dressed for her work day because she could not think of what else to do. Her choices at the moment were severely limited. Should she go to Sati, Yasmina knew the girl would ask about Missa. But Yasmina had neither the strength nor the imagination to tell her youngest daughter anything at this point. Until she herself knew more, Sati was going to have to find the inner resources to get through the day alone. It wasn't long after reaching this conclusion that Justin arrived to tell Yasmina what she already knew. Missa had never gone to work yesterday, and, what was worse, she had not returned last night.
"She came upstairs to dress," he told Yasmina. "She said that Rabia wanted her to speak to you, and she didn't see any way other than doing it, and then she never came back."
"She went to Ludlow," Yasmina told him.
"Why? She'd been crying. When she came upstairs her face was blotchy, and I could tell she was crying.
and she wouldn't tell me why. And what I want to know is what you lot did to her, because she said she was meant to talk to you, and let me tell you, I know you don't want us marrying, no matter what you say. I was that stupid ever to think, I want to know where she is.
She's with Rabia.
You lot are trying to separate us. Misa told me you'd do anything to stop her, like maybe even making her go to India.
That isn't true.
And I rang her, over and over, starting when she didn't come to work. She's not answering. So what have you lot done with her mobile?
Yasmina could sense the danger here, a strong young man filled with anger that she knew was righteous. She said to him,
I'm going to give you Rabia's number.
Ring it and she'll... I'm not having that. You tell me what's happened.
Misa will have to tell you.
I can't. Not after everything else I've done. Things for which I am responsible and sorry. Truly sorry, Justin.
When he took in these last statements, Justin altered. He said quietly,
I love her that much. Is she coming back?
I think she is.
You don't know for sure?
I don't know a single thing for sure.
I don't blame you, if you're unwilling to take me at my word, but it's all I have to give you.
It appeared to be enough, for the moment, that pathetic word she was offering him, and he went on his way to Blist's Hill to work. He told her he would ring Rabia, over and over if that's what it took. 40 minutes later she heard a car stop in front of the house. She hurried to the window in time to see Timothy get out of it. He paused to lean his head against its roof. She went to the door. They opened it simultaneously, he from the outside on the top step, she from the inside in the silence of the entry. Because she was looking for it without wanting to look for it, she saw the blood. It speckled the left shoulder of his shirt, the right sleeve of it as well.
A policeman was sent to Rabia, she told him. He asked her for a picture of you.
He looked utterly ragged.
I took care of things.
He headed towards the stairs. She planted herself in front of him and said,
What have you done?
I just told you.
You must tell me. Did you hurt someone?
The look he gave her was so contemptuous that she took a backward step from it.
No more than Mitter's been hurt, was his answer.
He pushed past her and went up the stairs. She shut the front door. Above her she could hear him walk into the bathroom. She heard the water running in the basin, too briefly for him to do anything but fill the glass he kept next to the cold water tap. She dashed up the stairs. She knew exactly what he was planning to do, but she swore to herself that he would not do it now. They were meant to talk to each other. She was too late. He'd managed to get more pills, and he was shaking two of them into his palm. She knocked them from his hand, crying,
Talk to me!
He didn't react, other than to shake two more into his hand. His fist clenched over them in such a way that she knew she wouldn't be able to wrest them from him.
We've talked enough, he said to her.
He slapped his palm against his mouth, downed the two pills, and left her. She followed him to their bedroom, crying,
Why are you doing this? One daughter dead, another sodomized, a third afraid to come home, and this is what you do? I come to you, I beg you, I need you. All of us need you, and this is your response?
Timothy said nothing. He let the silence go on as if with a wish that she would be able to hear what she herself had said. Which she could not, of course, because what she'd said was no longer there. Which was, of course, the problem with speaking at all.
You think that everything,
he gestured in the direction of the bathroom, by which she knew he meant his pills, started with Jana.
You see everything rolling along nicely in our family until her illness. We didn't cope with that well, did we? And then she died. And in your eyes we coped even worse.
You did everything you could not to feel. You still do anything not to feel.
No, he said, I did not do everything and anything. But it seems that way, because in your eyes there is only one way to grieve, and that's your way. What's gone wrong with us, you, me, the girls, is contained in your belief that you have some mystical power over everything that you consider an aspect of your life, and the biggest aspect of your life is every person in it and every circumstance that occurs.
What a terrible thing to say to me, when my entire life has been devoted—
Your life has been devoted to manipulating everyone in it. You haven't seen any of us as people. You've seen only how you could play us like chess pieces. But you can't look at that, because if you saw it, you'd have to do what you want me to do, and what you think I don't do, grieve and feel and, I don't know, howl at the moon at night in sheer rage because of what's happened and how it's all gone wrong.
Blame me, then. Make me at fault. Because if I am, it's so much easier for you to walk away from us all and live with yourself afterwards.
He frowned. He rubbed his forehead. He tapped his fingers hard against it.
"Yes," he said. "This isn't about fault. This is just what is."
He went to the bed then. He lay upon it, turning his back to her. Within a minute he was asleep. And she was left with what she was left with. Words forming accusations, accusations demanding guilt, guilt demanding reparation. Ludlow, Shropshire. When Linley rang him that morning, Raddick at once asked about the boys.
"One of the Shrewsbury officers stopped at the station to use a computer yesterday," he explained. "He told me what happened. I tried to get on to the Freemans half the night, but they're not answering calls. Are the boys all right? Is Finn all right?"
"My sergeant was at the hospital with the family most of the afternoon," Linley said. "This is Finn's family. We'd like to speak to you."
"Jesus! You're not thinking I attacked those two?"
"The attacker's been described, and he had reason. Or at least we presume that's what he believed."
"What kind of reason?"
"That's what we'd like to talk to you about. Shall we come to you? We're happy to do that." "No,
no.
Ruddock said he would meet them at the station as they'd done before. Could they give him 30 minutes? "They could give him 15, Linley told him. "If that wasn't possible, they were going to have to come to him. They would need his address." "He'd be there in 15 minutes, Ruddock said. Linley admitted to himself that over the phone Ruddock sounded normal, open about his attempts to ring the Freemans, speaking easily about the boys, ready to be helpful. Once the crime scene team had allowed it on the previous day, Linley and Dina Donaldson had done a search of Bruce Castle's room to find the clothing that she had thrown at him. Luckily, Bruce had merely kicked both the skirt and the top under the bed. Unluckily, they had lain there among various puffs of sluts' wool ever since. Unluckier still, months had passed since Missa Lomax had worn the clothes, and during that time they'd not only been hung in Ding's clothes cupboard without protection, but they'd also been handled by Ding herself, along with Brutus, or at least his feet. But Linley had a feeling they might come in useful, so when he and Ding had located them, he placed them in an evidence bag supplied by Socco. During this time, a photograph of the Lomax family had been fetched from Rabia Lomax and shown to Ding. She was openly reluctant to identify Mrs. Father as the man who had beaten both Finn and Brutus. She said,
"It's only that I saw him for maybe, I don't know, 5 seconds?"
But when they explained that there would no doubt be fingerprints on the fire poker, as well as on the front door, she was able to see that her word alone wasn't what was going to make or break an arrest of the man who'd assaulted her housemates. So then it was merely a nod, and,
"I feel that bad about it, see?"
Then Ding's mother had shown up to fetch her to Much Wenlock, crying,
"Ding, oh Ding, when I think what might have happened to you as well,"
and hugged her and kissed her and escorted her to the car she'd driven. She said,
"Thank you,"
with a fervency that suggested she believed Linley had done something to save the day, when all the day-saving had actually been accomplished by Ding herself. Had she not arrived at the house in Teamside when she had, one of the two boys probably would be dead. He'd returned to the hotel at that point. He not only wanted to wait in order to hear from Havers and be told exactly what they were dealing with, but he also wanted to think. Barbara had certainly been right in her assessment of Gary Ruddock. But in the absence of compelling evidence, he had to consider how they were going to pin anything on him. When Havers returned from Shrewsbury, she'd shared all the details she'd amassed from the hospital. There were few enough, as Finnegan Freeman remained unconscious. Brutus, on the other hand, had been able to describe the bloke he'd encountered as he'd left his room on the way to the loo. "Sounds like Timothy Lomax again," Linley commented. He told her about Ding's identifying Lomax as the man who'd entered their house. Thanks to an observant neighbour called Keegan, he said, they had the fire poker that had been used on both boys. Tossed over the wall that blocked access to the weir near to the Ludford Bridge, he told her. Socco had collected it for fingerprinting. Back at the hotel, they'd agreed to sleep on everything and meet in the morning. They would go to the police station then to learn why there had reportedly been no evidence on the undergarments of a girl who had been sexually assaulted. Thus they made their way there within the time frame that Lindy had given Ruddock over the phone. The PCSO showed up within moments of their own arrival. He was well-groomed, neatly dressed as usual, and he looked well-rested. Linley removed the evidence bag from his own car. He saw Ruddock's gaze flick to it, but the PCSO voiced no questions. He nodded to them both, unlocked the station, and said, "Coffee?" They both accepted. It would give them time to study the man. Had he not offered, they would have made the request anyway. In the erstwhile lunchroom, they chose the two plastic chairs available.
Linley put the evidence bag on one of them. Havers hung her lumpy shoulder bag from the back of the other. Then she said, "I'll just fetch," and took herself off to retrieve the desk chair from the office in which Ian Druitt had died. When she rolled it into the lunchroom, she did so wearing the latex gloves that Linley had instructed her to don. Ruddock had busied himself with the Nescafe, the mugs, the appropriate accompaniments of sugar, and, with apologies, a powdered substance that he called whitener, at which point he turned with a smile. The smile disappeared when he saw the latex gloves on Havers. Linley said in a disciplinary fashion, "Sergeant, you're getting ahead of yourself."
"Fingerprints? DNA? The whole bit," Havers replied stoutly. "If he sat in this chair, there'll be evidence of it, and evidence is what we need."
Ruddock said, "Do you mean Ian Druitt?"
"He didn't sit in it. It was a plastic one was in the office, like I said before when you asked me about the Socco pictures."
"Let's lay that aside for the moment," Linley said to Havers.
"With those scuff marks smeared on the floor? With what we know now? You're joking, Inspector."
"Can I ask what's going on?" Ruddock at last looked wary. "Just sit for a moment," Linley said to Barbara. "We'll get to things as they come." She said huffily,
"Oh, too bloody right."
She sat, not in the desk chair, but on the plastic one. First, however, she took her shoulder bag from the plastic chair and removed her notebook and pencil. Linley changed the location of the evidence bag from his chair to the table. Ruddock's eyes flicked to the bag, then away from it. He said,
"Something's happened. If you lot want my help, you're going to have to tell me what it is. All I know is that yesterday Finn Freeman and that other boy..."
"Brutus," Havers said. "He had his arm broken by some bloke shouting that his daughter had been raped. He reckoned one of the two boys did it, Brutus or Finn."
"Why do you reckon that, for God's sake?"
"Because it happened in the house."
"Jesus. When?"
"In December. After exams, this was. Binge drinking going on up in Quality Square that had to be dealt with because the neighbours were complaining like they do. Everyone pissed to brainlessness. Since you carted the group to Teamside, I suppose you remember."
Ruddock said, "I've dumped that lot in Teamside easy a dozen times since autumn. If someone's saying I did the same that night, I probably did."
"This night was rather different," Linley said, "because Ding ran off. Dina Donaldson, this is. That left the rest of them. Finn, Brutus, and a girl who didn't live there but who also didn't want to go home drunk. She's the girl who was raped. She told Ding about it, but no one else, at least not at first. Please sit down, Mr. Ruddock."
"The coffee?"
"I think I'll forgo it. Barbara?"
"As well."
She tapped her pencil against her notebook. She'd opened it to a pristine page. Ruddock took no chances with pouring the coffee. Hands shaking? Could be, but it was difficult to tell. He said,
"I'll do the same then,"
and sat in the rolling desk chair. It moved a bit. He braced his feet on the floor.
"That would be why it had to be plastic,"
Havers noted to Linley, indicating Ruddock's feet.
"But we reckoned that earlier, eh?"
"We did," he replied. Ruddock said nothing. One of his feet tapped on the floor, but when he seemed to realize that Havers had her gaze fixed upon his shoes, he stopped. He said,
"I've my rounds to do this morning, so how can I help you just now?"
Points for bravado, Linley thought. He said, "Aside from Ding, the raped girl told Ian Druitt about what happened that night. She saw Druitt a number of times."
7 times, sir," Havers put in.
"And it took a bit for him to get the story from her, as she'd been seeing him for another reason entirely. After what happened, she'd wanted to end her enrollment in the college, not returning for the spring term. She'd been talked out of that by her parents, but her coursework began to suffer, which, through various means that we don't need to go into here, brought her to Mr. Druitt's attention." Ruddock nodded.
"That makes sense.
He was a sympathetic ear, from what I've heard."
Yes.
Linley took the evidence bag, removing it from the table and setting it on the floor. Havers said,
"We spoke to the girl as well, Gary. Yesterday, this was. It was a rough go for her, but as she finally told her parents what happened, it made things a bit easier for her to talk about it to us. Now, in a general course of things, you wouldn't expect, all those months later, when she told Ian Druitt about the rape, that there would be any evidence of it. I mean, there'd be sod all on her body, and everything else would be compromised from here to Jerusalem, if you know what I mean. Only, see, this girl had never been drunk before that night, and she was ashamed because she thought she'd brought the rape on herself, so she wanted a reminder. Although, you ask me, it was more like a... what's one of those things that religious fanatics beat themselves up with, sir?"
"A scourge,"
Lindley said, his face fastened on Ruddock. A cat o' nine tails, that sort of thing.
Right, Havers said. But she didn't have a real scourge, did she? And anyway, people would have noticed if she started going round with blood seeping through her T-shirts and all that from using scourges on the back like people do. So she kept the underwear she was wearing that night, just like it was. She put it in a drawer, and although she didn't say this to us, I expect she brought it out now and then to give it a look, just to remind herself what a tart, scrubber, minge bag, cow, or whatever she'd been that night. Some girls do that, you know. And this girl? Seems like she was brought up to do it.
She gave her underthings to Ian Druitt, Lindley said. When he reported back to her, it was to say that he'd been told there was no evidence on them.
Which we reckon accounts for all those phone calls between you and the deacon, Havers said. Sympathetic bloke, like you said he was. He'd want to bring someone to justice if that person had raped this girl like she claimed. So he'd ring you to see where the forensic exam of her knickers and tights had got to. You'd tell him at first that there was no news. But he'd keep ringing, wouldn't he? Eventually you would have to say too bad, so sad, and all the rest. And because you're an officer of law, Gary, because that is what you bloody are, right? Ian Druitt would assume you were telling the truth, which meant that either the girl had cooked up the whole story for some reason, or it had actually happened, leaving no evidence. And in either case, no matter what she said to anyone else after Druitt, it would have been her word against the word of whoever it was did this to her. Especially if there wasn't any proof. Like you said, I mean.
What she didn't tell Ian Druitt, however, Lindley added, was this, Gary. While the undergarments were hers, the outer garments belonged to someone else. And that person, for all these months, kept them quite safe. She gave them to us yesterday. He touched his fingers to the evidence bag.
We reckon the rapist's DNA is on them, Havers said. What's your opinion on the matter, Gary? We'd like to have it from you. We've sorted Druitt's death, by the way.
Sir? And Lindley gave him the caution, slowly and clearly. Ruddock offered no reaction to this, aside from fingers tightening on the arms of the desk chair. Lindley said to him, Ian Druitt knew the identity of the girl who'd been raped. He knew about the evidence she'd kept. He passed that evidence on to you, and then he relied upon you to do what you were meant to do.
Which, Havers added, would have been to log it in, put it into the system, send it off for an analysis that was going to show... I had to protect him,
Ruddock broke in.
I was told to protect him. I'd have lost my job if I didn't protect him.
Are you talking about Finnegan Freeman? Lindley asked.
She asked me directly he came to Ludlow, just to keep an eye out. So what could I do? Say no to the Deputy Chief Constable? How could I do that? Would you do that? Would anyone? So when I found out, when Druitt told me what happened inside that house, I did what I could.
Which was what? Exactly, Lindley said.
I told her. Everything that supposedly had happened, because for all we knew, it hadn't happened at all, and the girl was lying, which is what I told Druitt at first. I know those boys, I told him. Whatever this girl is saying, it can't be true, I told him. This is about revenge or something, or anger or whatever. You need to speak with her about that. So he did, but then here he came with knickers and tights, and I knew exactly what that meant.
So he had to die?
I didn't think that. I never thought that. I reckon getting rid of the evidence would be enough, so I handed it over and that was that. But not for her. She had to be sure that no one ever learned what Finn did to that girl when she was drunk. Only Druitt knew, so...
So you killed him, Lindley finished.
No! I swear to God that I never did anything to that bloke except fetch him from St. Lawrence Church and bring him here to wait. Then I made my phone calls just like I said, and in the meantime someone did him in. You've forgotten the part about the vestry, Havers said.
Ruddock licked his lips. The right foot tapped again. Again he stopped it.
What about the vestry?
He demanded. It's where Ian Druitt removed his vestments while you were in the room waiting for him, Lindley explained.
I can't help if he took the opportunity. You were the one who took the opportunity, Gary, Havers said. You might have turned out to be less of an absolutely pathetic bloody tosser if you'd ever once gone to church in your life.
That'll do, Sergeant, Lindley said mildly. And then to Ruddock, you chose the wrong stole. The colours mean something. Ian Druitt didn't shove the stole he was wearing for the service into his pocket. He would have been wearing a purple one, for Lent. You chose red. Silence at this. It would have been quite nice had Ruddock, at any point, started to look like a truly trapped and finished animal, but that did not happen. This suggested he had cards to be played, and he intended to play them. What he didn't know, and couldn't possibly know, was that the ace was in Lindley's hand. The back door to the station opened, and Lindley tilted his head in that direction, indicating Havers should see to it. She rose to do so.
"She pressured me," Ruddock said when Havers was out of the room. "She wouldn't let up. Once I told her about Druitt and what he knew about that night from the girl herself, she was the one to ask about evidence. So I told Druitt there was nothing could be done unless there was evidence. He went back to the girl, and there it was, and he gave it to me, and I had to tell her I had it at that point. If I hadn't done, it would be Finn arrested, and Finn charged, and Finn convicted, and all because he made a wretched mistake one night in his life. The girl would heal up. It was bad for her, of course it was bad, but she'd heal, and if she only kept her mouth shut, no one would... I couldn't let the boy go to prison. He'd have been branded because of what happened, and I knew it, and so did Clover. The word would get out, and he'd be used by the others. The lags would have him. They would line up, and how the bloody hell was he to survive that, when he didn't have to, if there was no evidence of a crime in the first place?
I see. Lindley paused, frowning, eyebrows drawn together. Making sure that I understand, the evidence couldn't go to forensics because it had never been worn after that night, so it held DNA. So you either have it still, or you gave it to the deputy chief constable, because you had to be sure she saw you as following orders.
I gave it to her, just like I said. But Druitt still knew it existed, and she couldn't let that rest. I had nothing against the man. He was only doing what he saw as his duty. But she didn't want to risk it.
What?
That one of them, Druitt or the girl, might not believe the no-evidence story. That one of them might want to take their own story to the Shrewsbury police, ringing up and saying, "Here's what happened, only we're being told there isn't evidence, and how is that possible when a girl is sodomized?"
Ah. Lindley was silent for a moment. He produced an expression of deep thought, a man considering everything he'd heard and evaluating each bit of it. Finally he said, "That's just the problem, Gary."
"What is?"
"That you know the girl was sodomized."
"Druitt?"
"No. Not Druitt, and not anyone else. The girl never told a soul she'd been sodomized until yesterday. She was too ashamed."
"She had to have told."
"But she didn't. In her culture, or perhaps better said in the culture of her mother, a high value is placed on virginity, and while she was and is still technically a virgin, she couldn't bear the thought of telling anyone the exact nature of the attack upon her, in part because they might think she was no longer pure."
"It was Finn. I swear to you, it was Finn."
"That's certainly what you allow the DCC to believe, isn't it? She needed to be in a panic about her son so that everything could be organized, moving the CCTV camera outside the station here, making a call to the control room that was just vague enough that nothing would be done immediately about it, making that call from here so it could look like someone was trying to frame you, and finally the call to Sergeant Gunderson once a big enough crime was committed that would occupy the patrol officers who otherwise would have fetched Druitt to Shrewsbury when the DCC asked that it be done."
"I'm telling you."
"I'm sure you are. But once we got onto Druitt's mobile, things began to look worrisome for you. So you had little choice but to drag Finnegan into the story as someone Druitt was ostensibly worried about. But Druitt wasn't worried about anything regarding Finn, as he had both the truth and the evidence on his side. Until, of course, he hadn't."
"I was under orders. From her. DCC Freeman."
"Possibly. But I doubt any order she gave had to do with sodomizing a girl. Sergeant?" He directed this last towards the corridor. Havers came in. She was accompanied by two uniformed officers.
"These blokes will take you to Shrewsbury, Gary," she told Ruddock. "There's a lovely custody suite waiting for you there."
Royal Shrewsbury Hospital, near Shelton, Shropshire. Clover arrived in Finnegan's room round 9:30. She wasn't dressed for work, and she said to Trevor,
"Let me take this watch. You need some sleep."
Before Trevor could reply, Finn roused himself, saying,
"Mum?" She turned to the bed. "I'm here now, darling. Dad's going home to get some sleep, but one of us will stay with you till whoever did this is under arrest."
At Clover's appearance in Finn's room, Trevor had felt at once uneasy. He was reluctant to leave. He said, "I think I'll stay a bit longer."
"There's no need," Clover said. "And if anyone wants to speak with Finnegan, they'll have to deal with me."
Finn said in the same drowsy voice he'd had in the wee hours of the morning,
"Cops, you mean?"
Clover sat on the chair Trevor had risen from. She leaned towards the bed.
"They're going to want a statement from you, Finnegan," she said. "Unless you've spoken to them already. Have you? About what happened yesterday? About anything else?"
Finn hadn't been looking at her, but rather at the ceiling. Now, however, he turned his head, which showed his mother the extent of the injuries to his face, swollen and bruised and stitched up like a prize-fighter. He said to her,
"What?" "They may want to speak to you about something that happened last winter," she said. "If they do, if they bring that up... But I'll be with you, so we won't worry about it just now, unless they've already spoken to you. You haven't yet answered me about that."
At this point she turned to Trevor and said,
"He hasn't spoken to the police, has he? Did that Scotland Yard woman manage to get to him at some point last night?"
Finn said,
"Scotland Yard?"
Trevor said, "Your mum's worried you might speak to the Metropolitan Police again. Or, for that matter, to someone else."
"But you said, won't they want a statement?"
"I don't mean about what happened yesterday, Finn," Trevor told him. "I mean the other. What you and I were trying to work out last night."
"Last night?"
He squinted as if the daylight from the window bothered him. "We talked about the girl in Teamside. The assault," Trevor said. He could feel Clover shooting him a look, but he didn't return it.
"What? Was there a girl, Dad? Dean wasn't home when that bloke came at me. At least, I don't think."
"That's a memory thing, Finn. It's fuzzy at the moment, but the doctors said it should clear up over time," Clover said quietly.
"So he can't recall anything just now?"
And to Trevor she sounded far too relieved. He said to their son, "The Met Police are going to want to talk to you about a girl who passed out in your house last December. Your mum doesn't want that to happen, as the girl was apparently sodomized." Clover straightened from her position, bending over the bed. She said to him,
"Trevor, you'll not—"
But he stopped her with, "Your mum doesn't want you to speak to anyone about last December, Finn, because of where the questions might lead. Which means, I reckon, that she also doesn't want you to speak to the police about who it was attempted to kill you yesterday." Clover took a step from the bed. She said,
"A word, Trevor?"
But before she could lead him from the room to the corridor, where, doubtless, she wanted the word to occur, Finn said,
"But who sodomized mum?"
Clover's tone became fierce and low as she said to Trevor,
"That was foul of you."
Trevor said to their son, "You'll need to try to remember, Finn, everything you can about that night in December."
"It's impossible. He can't remember,"
Clover hissed.
"The doctor told us his memory will be faulty for a time."
"But he needs to try, doesn't he?"
"What he needs is to say nothing to anyone. Are we clear, Trevor?"
"Dad?
Mum?"
It came to Trevor not only how young Finn sounded, but also, when he glanced at him, how young he looked there in the bed, his head in bandages, and his eyes so liquid that it seemed only a superhuman effort was keeping him from weeping in front of his parents. "Your mum isn't going to allow you to speak to the police unless you're able to assure her, Finn, that neither rape nor sodomy is part of your repertoire when a girl is passed out from drink on your sofa." Clover hissed in a breath between her teeth. She said,
"How dare you?"
To which he responded, "What did you intend to do? You can't keep him from the police forever. You can be present if he wants you present, but you can't answer their questions for him."
"They'll trick him. They know how to do that. Do you actually think I'm in the dark about how police detectives work?"
"If he tells them the truth—"
"My God, you are impossibly naive. The truth means nothing. The truth never means a thing. When it comes to innocence or guilt, the truth is the very first casualty in an investigation. If he makes a single wrong step—"
"You think—" Finn's voice cracked, as it had done in puberty. They both turned to him.
"You think I did it? You think I—"
He lifted his good arm and covered his eyes. Clover's mobile rang. Trevor said, "Let it go." She looked at the screen and then at him.
"I can't," she told him. "It's headquarters."
That said, she walked out of the room. Coventry, Warwickshire. Yasmina wasn't oblivious to the irony of where her parents had chosen to live as pensioners, since they had sent her to Coventry directly after she'd revealed to them, during her second year at uni, that she'd secretly married an English boy. They might have come round eventually to the idea of her marrying beyond their wishes, religion and ethnicity, but that she'd become pregnant by that English boy prior to marrying him was another matter entirely. for a pregnancy declared she'd violated their cultural and religious beliefs regarding the vital importance of a woman's purity. More important than that, however, turned out to be their fury that, in getting herself